Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Enlightened Radio's Labor Beat Radio Show with my good friends J.B. Christensen and Scott Marshall. J.B. is the president of our regional labor council here, and Scott is very active in the steel workers, and he's the vice president of something over there. You know, and my name is John Case, and I'm the former UE organizer, and I help out on the labor council as well here. And
you do all the work, John.
You know, labor. Anyway, this is Labor Beat Radio, and so I was gonna, I put up a little webpage today to remind myself, you know, the kind of thing I wanted to talk about, and the inspiration was I was listening to, you know, a panel discussion on Palestine last weekend, and there was an old guy I've known for years and years and years who's very active in the peace movement way back in the 60s and everything, and you know, he was talking about, you know, the new generation in a new environment, about where you need to demilitarize and raising some of the big questions that were raised during Vietnam about the military industrial complex, quote unquote, and all this, you know, it's all about, as my friend Mr. Bill says, it's all about the bullets. It's all about the bullets. You know, someone's got to sell bullets. That's why you got to have all this war. Anyway, and he used this phrase, just transition, to, like, and I know he means this. I know this guy, so I know he means it. But at the end of each of these big changes that need to be take place in the militarization of the economy, you need to have a just transition. And, of course, in you know, the environmental movement, it just rang a bell for me, because, of course, in the environmental movement, you know, the question of getting rid of coal and natural gas and fossil fuels, you know, also, you know, the progressive voices in the whole thing also, you know, frequently will say, oh, there needs to be a just transition for, you know, affected workers and their families and in these industries. And then only last week, I saw a major study, you know, endorsed by Stanford and released mostly under the aegis of the OpenAI, which is very closely associated with Stanford, in response to how are we going to be able to measure the number of jobs that are going to be displaced by artificial intelligence technologies like the generative AI, known as GPT chatbots right now. And so the study basically showed that $30 million jobs, at least, would be lost. And there might be other new jobs and transformed like that, but, you know, 30 million. And they used that based on a study of, you know, what skills the chatbots can do that would, as well as comparable high school or college graduates, what sorts of skill sets could they perform and be trusted to perform? And based on that, big numbers. So, 30 million jobs from AI. The oil, gas industry, and all the people that run service stations and stuff like that, probably 2 million jobs. The military and the Defense Department, okay, also probably close to, if you count defense industries and those directly in the military, both civilian and military, you got about, 4 to 5 million altogether in that. So, you know, in terms of, like, when we talk about what is a just transition, we're talking about close to 35 to 40 million jobs and those families that are affected. And you know, I know that the people who use the phrase just transition are, in my experience, mostly sincere. But I'm not sure, unless there's a big consensus to do something very specific about that question, what happens to displaced workers and families, then what happens is that the market decides. If you can't do something different, if you can't agree widely enough to get something else done, the market decides. And which in late stage U.S. capitalism, right, like we got right now, that means the billionaires decide, because they dominate most of the market. And then, of course, the most profound question for me, I'll just be straightforward about it, is that if you can't provide a just transition, where do you stand then? Do you make promises to people and stay with them regardless? I mean, what's the working class politics and labor movement morality that's going on here? That's my question for today. What is a just transition, really? Anybody?
Well, not really practical, but I say a just transition is the 2-hour work week.
I love it. Sign me up. That's 2 more than I do now.
Well, for retirees, it wouldn't make any difference.
Right. Well, we'll work 2 hours.
Yeah, just to get it.
Give me a job, John.
Well, so what do we do? I mean, so for example, you go ahead, JB.
We've always managed to transition through the ages when things change. And this will be no different. The 30 million jobs that you have read about that are going to be lost are not necessarily lost, but they've lost their original purpose. The unions and the labor market will always figure it out and start training people to take these new jobs as they come up. And it's going to take a long time. It's going to take probably 10 years before any of this ever happens. But that'll give plenty of time for the workforce to be trained up in these new jobs and also stimulate entrepreneurism. I mean, you go on TikTok, you go on Instagram or Facebook or any of the social media, every day there's a new job. There's a new entrepreneurial spirit that's out there that, you know, allows people to become more creative, working for themselves and putting food on the table. So I'm not worried about the 30 million jobs lost as much as I'm worried about educating the new workforce to take over these new jobs. That's pretty much how it happens over time. And unless you think this is going to be monumental and there's no way to rebound from it, no way to actually navigate it, then I think my theory will be correct. If we don't train up the workforce, we could be in trouble.
Well, that's that latter part. I'm sort of a glass half empty guy on this whole matter, but you know, I don't think so, JB. I mean, on I just look at the past 35 years of what happened when we moved toward, free trade, at least in manufacturing, and we didn't do anything to really transform the workforce and prepare it for what was clearly the growing jobs and that were paying decent wages, which was IT. And nobody and no other sector at all, really. Okay. So it would have taken a huge public investment in education, especially in areas that don't have the money to do it themselves. And we didn't do that. And I think the result was Donald Trump.
Yeah.
I think the result was Donald Trump, especially as it affected this sort of declassing, middle classing of white workers that had decent jobs and then didn't have any jobs that were shit afterwards. And, and whole areas of the country, just like a little plague went through. And so now you have an acceleration of those technologies beyond, the software is moving beyond what I think anything that happened in the 70s. So I think the problem is that if you let it go just by itself, then advanced U.S. capitalism is going to decide the matter. The power of these what 12 billionaires control 85% of the U.S. media. So I mean, what's going to happen is that this inequality scale between the rich and the poor, everybody else, is just going to get bigger and bigger. They can't stop it. They can't stop it. The billionaires cannot stop that, even if they wanted to. And they don't, So it's built in that accumulation cycle. Unless there's a changeover, JB, who's gonna pay for the schools to do this, who's gonna do it? Who's gonna be taxed to pay for it?
The billionaires.
Uh huh. Well, not this Congress.
First thing we're going to do is repeal Citizens United and get money out of politics. We don't do that, we're screwed.
Well, you're talking about after the revolution, my friend. You're not talking about this system right we got going right here, this Congress. No, they're not going to do that. How could they possibly
They won't do it easily.
How would you get enough money out of the system to have a fair election and to overturn Citizens United? What election is going to allow you to do that? I mean, it's bought and paid for on that kind of. They don't seem to be able to move on this.
Well, when the Democrats have a huge victory in November, which I'm predicting now.
Okay.
A huge, huge tidal wave victory. And we get a lot more Democrats and progressives into the House of Representatives and hopefully the Senate.
Right.
Because you have to have both. And you have to have a president. So, I mean, you're right. It's the odds are against us. But in the name of for survival, we have to do it. We must do it. And I think when the chips are down, people are going to mobilize and they're going to get woke and they're going to reject the GOP and the Trump and Tuberville and all those crazies. The new speaker in the House comes to mind. He's another one. They're all going to be gone. They're all going to be gone this time next year, John.
Yeah, I heard that before.
Well, it's going to happen. It has to happen, or else we're all going to be.
The hope that I see is what happened in the United Auto Workers strike and SAG-AFTRA. That's where I see hope. That solidarity amongst working class people, labor people, but working class people, that is power. That's power to actually do something rather than just, you know, talk about it. Right. And what is it that we have to expand that solidarity? You know, people have to see, working people, if they can't see that you have whatever your individual opinions are about up and down and right and left and whatever, if you don't stick together and subordinate some of your stuff to the stuff that everybody needs to have something done about, then you're not going to get anything. And that sign that, you know, all those auto workers that were out there at Martinsburg, they didn't all agree about a whole bunch of shit, okay? They didn't agree about Sean Fain. They didn't agree about this. They didn't agree. But they did agree that they had to stick together behind the leadership to win, and they had to do it 100%. And that understanding, and they won. They won doing that. So that's, to me, whatever expands solidarity, go with it. Because you got two choices. Either the people unite and they decide on what they can agree to decide, or these billionaires are going to decide all of it, including the army they own.
There's one more place where we have to get a lot of votes. One more.
Yeah.
The streets.
Yes.
We've got to be in the streets fighting for those votes. And I think that a whole lot of the working class, especially the unions, realize that. I think the mobilization around the elections this time is going to be huge because of the labor movement, knocking on doors, talking to people on the streets. I mean, I really do.
I hope you're right, Scott. Past elections around here would indicate otherwise. We have more apathy in our Central Labor Council than I've ever seen. But that's just, you know, the last couple of election cycles. I'd like to get back to the more activism amongst the labor market. But a lot of the guys that we count on are working. They're already working 50 hours a week or more, and they got families. And they don't have time to go around knocking on doors and getting yelled at. They're all kind of paranoid about it. So I don't get much help at all when I ask the members to knock on doors and to show up for rallies and leafleting and voter registration, whatever it is. I'm having more and more trouble in my local area here recruiting members, retirees, family members. I mean, we could go after family members that have more time to be able to do this stuff. But we have to elicit that that passion amongst our members to realize that this is it. This is it. We can't go anywhere from here. We've got to win this election. We got to win it big.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't know what is Chicago, but John will tell you, it's hard to get people to volunteer around here. As John knows too. I mean, he's getting to the point where he has trouble seeing. You know, he might go to the wrong house.
I go to the wrong house. I did the last time I went around. Oh man!
Next thing you know, they string them up in the backyard. You know.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I went visit all the Republicans at Harper's Ferry. You know, but
I will say again that the need to mobilize and realizing that is going to be at a much higher level. So even with all of that, I think there's going to be a lot more activism.
I think you have to address this. The solidarity will be damaged if we cannot effectively address the just transition question.
Yep.
It's a key part of doing it. You know, there's no reason why Cecil Roberts should not be at these in the streets with us. And I think he will be. He has to be. You know, he just has to be. And so, you know, whatever it takes, you know, really to have that happen.
Exactly.
You know,
we should have Liz Schuler on this call.
Well, that's true. We get on. No, why don't you call her? Why don't you get a hold of her? You're a direct officer. Go ahead. I think you should call her, JB.
Yeah.
I don't know Liz.
I think you could call her. I don't.
I will.
I'll call her.
Yeah,
Scott probably has called her.
No, I haven't called her. I've talked. I used to talk to, you know, our friend that died.
Oh, or Sean Fain. I mean, he's already shown his ability to mobilize.
Oh, he is. Yeah. I'm just trying to. Send out requests.
Yeah. Leader.
Yeah.
He might be up there with our good friend Cecil.
Well, he had an interesting video after the strike where he put forward the idea that the best way to expand the solidarity would be to have more contracts go out at the same time. spread it so you're going, you're building the strike or the capacity to strike. Let's put it that way. And I call that the the Jim Mattless super syndicalist path to socialism, but you know, it's okay. You know, it's easy to, it's probably, maybe it's the best way to go, but.
Well, you know who else is proposing something like that?
Go ahead.
The Starbucks workers and the Amazon workers.
Right.
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 Those are calling great.
For a national contract.
Yeah.
And
so I think.
Remember the last time that was done? That's what created the CIO. And then think about the kind of activism that came out after the CIO was founded. It was an incredible time.
Well, it was a world war. I'm going to be set the stage. Well,
that's another thing we got to be in the streets about.
Yeah, there's a lot that's got to be accounted for. And I don't know. I don't know that we're good. It looks pretty wobbly to me, even though I think you're right that the capacity
wobbly?
Of people.
Wobbly?
The republic that we live in.
The IWW?
No, the republic. the three branches. The three branches of government, you know. Well, the IWW would be right along like Sean Fain. I mean, he's probably a card-carrying member.
You know, he might be.
If he's not, I don't know. I'd ask him why not. You know, I mean, it's a similar theory. You know,
but the dues are only $25, right?
Well, they haven't gone up much since 1910.
maybe that's a way we could do it. We could unite the workers by having them join the Wobblies.
Oh man, yeah, there was some big. A manufacturing company I remember the Wobblies organized up in upstate New York, and because the Wobblies didn't believe at that time in negotiating a contract, the idea of negotiating a contract with the steel company was like a sellout. You know, contract next day they'll just inflate everything in the company store and take all the money back from you. You know,
so they knew that.
In some company towns, they did do that. That's true. But anyway, they were going to go. They proposed to organize the place and, you know, come to work every morning. But nobody goes to work until the terms and conditions of labor for that day are settled. Then they go in and every morning you'd have to come back and set up the picket line before you negotiated the terms. Well, everybody was excited for the first few days, but that got old pretty fast. So they did have to sign a contract. But
did either of you guys ever Ever hear of Red Mountain, Alabama?
I think I've heard about it from you, but I'm not sure.
You remember what I told you?
No, I don't.
Well, the Wobblies created a supplemental, or I don't know, a different a union to use in Alabama. And they, the Red Mountain produced coal and the stuff for steel. And so the Wobblies were the first ones to organize both of those unions together into one union. And to this day, there's a museum there, and if you go to that museum, and you, as soon as you walk in the front door, there are these huge pictures of taken at the time of the leadership of the union, and it's half black and half white.
Wow.
That's great.
What year was that?
Oh, way back in the 1800s.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. They were pretty incredible.
No, the Wobblies had a great tradition.
It's, sure did.
Anyway, we're looking for ways to expand. I just think if we could figure out, you know, if actual transition plans, I mean, you could start the coal miners, for example. I'm sure that I don't see any reason why they probably already have all this documented. But I think you bring the terms of what would be a fair transition in these complicated cases, or at least you say, okay, the people affected are going to have a say about it. That's the number one thing. Okay. Yeah. I mean, right? I mean, you're going to have, if I'm working in a coal mine and they're going to close the coal mine down for national, in the national interest, and I'm a patriot, and I say, yeah, okay, I'm for it. But by the way, is there any compensation for doing this? You know, what is it? Because I think, you know, that's what is the compensation? And if there's none, then, you know, I'm going to be inclined to oppose the whole business. All right, since people don't give a shit about me, I don't give a shit about them either. You know, kind of attitude, which is goes, you know. So I think you just got to tend to these matters, you know. But
absolutely.
Anyway, that's my judgment on that. But I come up with a program. What about the payoff? You could do it in money. It's easy to explain to people rather than come up with the exact combination of educational benefits of, you know, early retirement or extended medical care or, relocation efforts or whatever, you know, whatever kind of that, but you could reduce it to money, a certain amount per family, per worker. Then at least, you know, I think it's an amount that the private companies don't want to pay, but, you know, compared to the downstream social costs of ignoring, you know, the human needs involved, really, the cost is going to be small doing everything right. You know, it'll be less than what happens later through neglect. It's just...
Well, one thing you have to keep in mind is capitalism is pretty short-sighted.
Well, that's true. I mean, you have to turn a profit this quarter, not three quarters from now. Well, you need to have, I'm not saying that it's time to go out and nationalize every, you know, shoe shine parlor. Okay.
No, let's leave the little guys alone.
I mean, and I'm not even interested in, you know, government, you know, running sections of the economy where, you know, the market works well to satisfy what people want and need. I mean, that, right. You know, but on the other, but I think there's this thing that happens with the too big to fail corporations in the main, where the liability involved to the society is just, it's too big for them to be able to operate without supervision, or more supervision. And in some cases, you know, really, you know, we got almost 2 million people in the armed forces. Probably a million of them have the skills to be released to help do what needs to be done. But anyway, I'm not sure what the answer is to at the top level. You know, do you nationalize Facebook, for example?
Good luck with that.
Well, I'm serious. You know, it's a,
no,
it's a problem.
I know.
That'd be a lot of jobs.
Yeah.
Well,
sure
I mean, would it really? I mean, you know, Facebook is finances itself based on advertising mostly. Yeah. Right. And they have 4.5 billion accounts around the world, and those accounts have richer profiles than anything that the U.S. government has on those people. You know, I mean, they've recorded their most intimate ideas, feelings, political views, problems, behaviors, all that stuff. You know, you can argue about it, who owns it, but Facebook has it. You know,
isn't that so, TMI though?
They don't have. There's no restriction on what they use it for themselves. Only restrictions they say is they won't give it to somebody else, or some of it to somebody else. But as to terms of their own AI algorithms, sky's the limit.
But what would the government do if they nationalized it? How would they run it differently than what it's being run now?
Well, you wouldn't have to, even if you didn't run it, if you said, for example, that, take, for example, the information that's stored, okay, that people's personal information and profiles. So if a private corporation has it, like Facebook, well, then a national security argument for a government, let's call it a democratically accountable government, would be, if you're going to have it, we have it too. So now that's actually what the Chinese did 5 years ago. Okay. That's what they told the Tencent and Alibaba and those guys. Your profiles on our population are bigger than ours. If we need to, we're going to tap yours. You know, that's what they did. They did that thing. Now, and everybody argued about it, but I see that in the U.S., you know, there's not too many other solutions that are actually out there. And I'm not sure even how much that is a solution. If the government, what happens if the government's unaccountable and it has, well, then you have, you know, if Trump is president and he has access to all the personal private information of everybody he wants, I mean, okay, is that better or worse than Facebook having it? You know, so.
Well, I have an opinion about that.
Go ahead.
It's a hell of a lot worse.
Trump, yeah. You mean Trump, yeah.
Yes.
But it limits who has the right to that information. Once you put it on somebody's software platform, you can't keep them from seeing it.
Yeah.
You know, that's not feasible. But you can make it more public. And basically now people say are put in a position, whatever you put on that platform, you should assume it's public.
Yep.
I mean, and in which case it can be at least publicly accessible. Yeah. I don't know.
No, you're right.
I mean, I never put anything up on Facebook that myself that, you know, that I guess that's not entirely true. I guess I have shut my mouth up more than once. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, I try to assume it's public speech.
You wouldn't mind having public here.
Well, yeah. I mean, I assume, but it's public speech that we're engaging in here on this radio station, for example, right?
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely public speech. And we're lucky that we're able to do that. I guess in other countries, they probably, you know, stop that. They probably don't allow blogs.
Well, I mean, I think if you're in Saudi Arabia, that, yeah, there's, you'd have to limit your blogging topics.
The price of oil.
You couldn't talk about that.
You wouldn't be able to talk about so obvious.
Yeah, man. Yeah. It's a mess. Well, guys.
We got to get hold of a Wobbly and figure out how we're going to organize everybody.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think.
$25 a year.
I think there are some active Wobblies. I'm sure there are some active Wobblies.
Right now. Right now is the time. We got to strike when the iron's hot.
National one-day work stoppage, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, organized by the Wobblies, and if you want to join a union,
okay,
you can
now
sign up tomorrow.
What do you think we could get? There's the workforce of the United States is 160 million, something like that. So, suppose we had a goal of getting at least a third of them to take the day off. What do you think we could get? What kind of demand? Or statement or whatever would justify a third of the people taking the day off in agreement?
Overturning Citizens United. It would be a demand from the people that the government do their job.
You think they would support that? Take a day out, lose a day's pay.
And also, we got to take care of the Supreme Court. That's another thing that's totally broken.
Okay, two demands.
Yeah. So I don't know how you get rid of the Supreme Court, but you got to start over on that point too.
Well, you know, one thing that should be thought about is asking Sean Fain, because the tactics that he used in the strike were pretty damn great.
It's brilliant.
They were.
Brilliant. But they weren't new. They weren't new. These are tactics that have been developed over the years. I think I alluded at an earlier podcast that I was in Australia back in the early 80s they had a polling strike. And they had three or four different unions on each tugboat. So in order to stop trade, they would have one union go out. The other three would show up, but they couldn't operate the tugboat without all four unions.
Four, yeah.
So, and they did that. The next day it would be a different union on strike, and the other one that was on strike will come back to work. So they all got paid. They got paid for the work that they did, but they weren't able to do any work.
Right.
So that was very brilliant. And I think that's where Sean Fain got his idea. I could be wrong.
The rolling strikes have been done in the past, but you know, there's an antidote to the rolling strike that depends on what the level of unemployment is. But if the companies have high unemployment and it's a rolling strike, they can use the lockout. One, because they can get scabs, and two, depends on how long people can go. You know, I mean, it varied by industry. Paper industry was like this a lot in the old days. You had to time things when they weren't going to do the annual shutdown. I mean, there was lots of issues, and Plus, in the old days, you had a lot of different unions in these mills, okay, before the CIO. If you look at industries that predate the CIO, they usually were organized, if they were organized, by craft unions. And so they would have, you know, like the paper makers were different than the machine tenders and the paper that this. I'm just thinking out of the paper industry in particular, but you had a lot of different crafts, riggers, so anyway,
probably a few Bobbleys in there too,
right? And you know, so it just depends. Like the very high levels of employment, and also GM's vulnerability to Biden, because Biden said hands off. Which was, you know, he did it. He didn't do it with the railroads, but he did do it with auto. And he showed up on a picket line, which is, I mean, everyone knows Bernie shows up on picket lines, but we heard that Biden was a union guy, but okay, and he did, and so that put GM in a bad spot, you know, to say no. So they were so they couldn't do a lockout.
Yeah.
You know, and so Sean Payne, the leadership, I'm sure this was a collectively developed plan at the top leadership to be able to look at the precision with which they carried it out. Look at the tactical awareness. People, you know, there were people in some places that were more pissed off that they didn't go out first than they were at other places.
You know, Steve Nofke said the people in his local were saying, come on, we all got to go out. Come on.
Right. But everybody was very disciplined. And, man, so that doesn't happen just because of one guy. You know, that people were working together. You know, when you see it happen sometimes, I remember some machine shop locals in New England that were had years, and you would have thought from the meetings that they wouldn't be able to eat dinner at the same table without stabbing each other. But man, when it came down to a showdown with the company, everybody broke bread together. it was they'd been there before, and they understood, you know, that okay, if we're gonna take them on, nobody can break ranks. Yeah. That and it would work, you know, even in a local union that was large enough to have, you know, like a 500 or 600 member local that had enough leadership reservoir, okay, to persist, right? And just because one generation of leaders would retire or become inactive or find other employment, there was, you know, they had built a culture of union participation enough sufficiently in the place to recreate themselves, which was also a pretty good thing. Didn't always work.
Another thing that really contributes throughout all of this is how strong the union educates its members on issues like these. And the fact that so many, the steelworkers have regular schools and districts have classes all the time on all aspects of labor. And I think that's a really important component.
The resources for doing that in West Virginia have been diminished by the right to work, as well as the attack on checkoff. So the money available for that, including for our retirees organization, has been hit. We're not at the level we were even a year ago. We had to cancel our Alliance for Retired Americans convention for this year, mainly just because important people that had played key roles in the past had retired, really retired, in addition to being maybe officially retired, also really retired, you know, Pat, and not enough folks to replace.
I think you're right about that, John, but that was not discussed when they canceled the meeting. They said it was a money issue.
Yeah, well, in years before, Sherry Breeden was very active in sending out the ads, okay, and seeing that ads got sent out and therefore money pledged, which was then used to compensate the AFL-CIO, which was always the backstop for paying the bills. And they felt that since Sherry retired and the other Sherry retired and et cetera, et cetera, and Jenny also wanted to retire. So since that all happened, the ads never got sent out. So they were going to be in a situation of having to have the FFL fund the entire thing without even the, what do you call it?
Right.
Propriety of, you know, some compensation.
Right. Yeah, they couldn't do it.
Yeah, they didn't feel right about doing it, you know, so.
Yeah.
That's what I heard that yesterday.
No, I think you're right, but it wasn't explained that way. But now that you bring that up, I think you're spot on.
You know, so.
That's too bad. Well, John, we've kind of passed our time.
We are. Yes, true. The chickens are out of the coop, you know. the rooster's flown away. Harper's Ferry
I'm going to go see Mr. Bill this afternoon.
Well, you should. You know, go see Mr. Bill. You know, he's a.
I am. I can't wait to see him. It's been so long.
He's better.
Who's Mr. Bill?
Oh, he's a friend of ours at the. This farm. He's
a labor, his old hippie, he's a labor guy.
The old hipster farm. He's one of our listeners here.
Oh,
yeah. Oh. All right.
Is it a chicken farm?
Lots of ducks. Lots of chickens. Yeah, and a number of geese, pheasants.
Dogs and cats.
Dogs, I cats.
Feel right at home there. My grandfather was a chicken farmer.
And there's a forge there. There's a modest machine shop. There's a carpentry shop.
They got everything.
There's a kiln.
A coffee pot?
Well, there was a coffee pot, but I don't know.
Who knows?
Several people have become injured.
I'll find out, Scott.
Not everybody is in as good a shape as they were a couple years ago.
Yeah, I hear you.
All right, everybody. All right, thanks, everybody, for tuning in to Labor Beat Radio today on www.enlightenradio.org. And you can check out podcasts.enlightenradio.org for our past shows. And I'll have today's up in a few hours. Anyway, take care of each other. It's late, but everything comes next.
Recording stopped.